Hi, Marco Werman here. You know my voice from the show, but what you don't often hear are the voices who work behind the scenes. Many talented people bring you the world each day. If you've ever wondered who makes our show, come meet us at theworld.org/whoweare. You'll see the superhero staff that makes the world what it is. The World's Newsroom digs deep into every story, takes risks, and shines a light on the communities most impacted by the headlines. Please take a moment to meet our staff. You'll find us at theworld.org/whoweare. And while you're there, you can also make a difference today in the work that we do by donating $100 or more. That's just $8.33 a month. Your gift can help us keep the show accessible to everybody. Help us make our goal, $100,000 from at least 1,000 donors, and you'll receive a personal invite to a virtual party with the incredible people who make the show. Once again, visit theworld.org/whoweare to learn about our team and donate today. From everybody here at The World, thanks.
The world rejoiced with a third vaccine in the pipeline, but celebrations and purchases may have been premature.
What do we do with 100 million doses of a product that isn't protecting as well as the alternatives?
Also today, we remember a soccer legend and Diego Maradona's legacy beyond the soccer field, befriending leftist Latin American leaders.
Most notably, Hugo Chavez of Venezuela and Fidel Castro of Cuba.
I'm Carol Hills. Also today, one man's spiritual quest to find the perfect cup of coffee.
So I would go to these villages. And I went to 32 different regions across Yemen. I would go to these places I would read about, and I would go and I would look for coffee.
How to brew that perfect cup. That's ahead today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. On the outskirts of Tehran, a prominent Iranian nuclear scientist was killed today. His name was Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Fakhrizadeh was said to be Iran's most senior nuclear scientist. At this point, no country or group has taken responsibility for the killing of Fakhrizadeh. To help unwrap this developing story, we're joined now by Abbas Aslani. He's a senior research fellow at the Center for Middle East Strategic Studies, and he joins us from Tehran. First of all, Abbas Aslani, what do we know at this point about the death of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh? What happened?
Well, according to what has been reported, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was in one of the outskirts of Tehran called Damavand, which is east of the capital city. There are some reports that there was an explosion in the beginning to damage or to kill his bodyguards. Then it was followed by shootings at his car in order to kill him. So he was transferred to hospital, but he didn't survive.
And those details you're reporting, they come from Iran state media, don't they?
I have been referring to some Iranian media who reported the incident in the early hours.
Who was Mohsen Fakhrizadeh?
You know, he wasn't a public figure. And when this was reported, people was figuring out what was his position. There was a statement by Iranian defense minister that referred to him as the chief of the research and innovation organization of defense ministry.
What are Iranian officials saying about what happened today, and what is the Iranian state media reporting?
What we are mostly hearing is the word of revenge. They say that this assassination is similar to a terrorist act, and some say it's an act of war, so it needs to be responded. And they're talking about a severe revenge. Iranian chief of staff of Iranian armed forces, Bagheri, today, he reacted to this issue, and he said that a severe or harsh revenge awaits for those perpetrators of this act.
Are Iranian officials or state media, are they attributing Fakhrizadeh's death to anyone?
There has not been any official, I can say, investigation and conclusion on this. But according to some Iranian officials, including Foreign Minister Zarif, as well as Chief of Staff of Iranian Armed Forces, they have been referring to Israel. Iranian top military commander Bagheri also said, Israel and global arrogance. By global arrogance, they mean the United States, but they have mostly referring to Israelis.
What's the evidence that Israel's involved?
This was an operation which cannot be done by small groups. It needed tracking and some intelligence support to find the location of Fakhrizadeh, as well as how to conduct that assassination.
But to be clear, we don't have any actual evidence yet of who's behind today's killing. Now, a spokesman for the Israeli military has said, we don't comment on reports in the foreign media. The prime minister's office said it would not comment on those reports. How do you explain the timing of this killing? I mean, why now?
You know, after the winning of Joe Biden in the presidential election in the United States, some people are worried that Biden administration in the United States, they might re-enter into the Iranian nuclear deal. And they are afraid that diplomacy is revived, like Israel, like Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and the Trump administration. Those who are supporting the maximum pressure against Iran, they are afraid that there can be an engagement between Iran and the United States in future. So they are trying their best in order to hinder that process, or at least to complicate it.
Abbas Aslani is a senior research fellow at the Center for Middle East Strategic Studies. He's been speaking to us from Tehran. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you. It was good to be with you.
Earlier this week, there was jubilation in England and really across the globe when the pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca announced results from phase 3 trials for a vaccine for the coronavirus. AstraZeneca's vaccine, developed in conjunction with Oxford University, was touted as offering a high level of protection against COVID-19. And the really good news, the vaccine is cheaper and easier to distribute than the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines produced here in the U.S. But since that initial burst of excitement, scientists have been asking questions, and they're worried that the vaccine may not be as effective as advertised. From London, our European correspondent Orla Barry joins me now. Orla, remind us what was announced at the start of the week about this AstraZeneca vaccine.
Well, on Monday, in a press release, Oxford University said their vaccine in phase 3 trials was showing itself to be 70.4% effective. And initially, Carl, for most of us hearing the news, it was actually a little bit disappointing, because in comparison to what we had heard from Moderna and Pfizer, for example, who were both reporting efficacy of around 95% a few weeks earlier, 70.4 actually didn't sound that great. But then the scientists came out and said, look, that figure of 70% isn't quite straightforward, because actually the vaccine was 62% effective when people on the trial got 2 full doses of the jab. But when they gave a half dose to a different group in the trial, followed by a full dose, the vaccine was 90% effective. And so these 2 figures would mean the vaccine has an overall efficacy rate of 70%.
And then, as I understand it, scientists have started asking questions about those 3 figures.
They did, because as the week went on, it emerged that the only reason they came up with the second result of 90% was that a mistake had been made during the trial. So what happened was, in error, they gave a group of participants in one of their trials a half dose, and they only realised their mistake when those members of the trial came back for their second jab, and none of them reported any side effects, the usual kind of a sore arm or a high temperature. And the researchers wondered why, and they figured that they'd given them the wrong amount. And it was this group of people who produced the 90% results. But there's a further problem. This group, all the participants in it, were under 55 years of age. And as we know, most of those affected, most badly affected by the coronavirus, are those who are older than that age bracket. So now this has raised further questions.
Now, what has AstraZeneca said since this all came out?
A company spokesperson said yesterday that their trials, their vaccine clinical trials, were conducted to the highest standards. But their CEO now has also come out to say in the last 24 hours that they're planning to launch a new global trial testing that half dose.
What's interesting is I see today the UK government has already asked the regulatory body that licenses vaccines in Britain to start the approval process for this. So it's pushing ahead despite some of the scientists' concerns?
Yes, exactly. In fact, actually, Carl, the Department of Health has already ordered 100 million doses of the vaccine here. But there are scientists who are out today cautioning against the government here being too dependent on it. Professor David Salisbury, he's the former director of immunisation at the UK's Department of Health. He was talking to the BBC earlier.
If this vaccine came through at truly 90%, then that would be a great result. But if it comes through at 62%, then I think you have to think very carefully, what do we do with 100 million doses of a product that isn't protecting as well as the alternatives?
I should say some scientists are more optimistic because they make the point that, look, these are unprecedented times. We always said that to get a vaccine that's over 50% effective would be great. And that was the cutoff point for regulators here. And as one scientist was saying earlier, if this result had come out 3 weeks ago, we would all have been over the moon.
The world's Orla Berry in London. Thanks a lot, Orla.
You're welcome, Carl.
The nation of Argentina is in 3 days of national mourning. Argentines are paying their final respects to soccer legend Diego Maradona, who died on Wednesday. On the field, Maradona was considered one of the greatest ever. Off the field, Maradona was also made his mark, inserting himself in Latin American politics. The world's Jorge Valencia reports from Mexico City.
Diego Maradona scored his two most famous goals here in Mexico City's Aztec Stadium. On June 22, 1986, Maradona led Argentina to knock England out of the World Cup. First, he illegally pushed in the ball with his hand in a play that became known as the Hand of God. Then, 3 minutes later, he blazed past the English defense and goalie to punt the ball in, legally this time, into the goal. The Argentinian narrator said thank God for soccer, for Maradona, and for the tears he was shedding. Just 4 years earlier, the British military had defeated Argentina in a war where some 850 soldiers were killed on the Falkland Islands. Maradona spoke about it in a documentary film released last year.
Una sensación linda, como una revancha simbólica a los ingleses.
Defeating England gave us a nice feeling, Maradona said, like a symbolic revenge against the English.
Lamentablemente, a veces la revancha nosotros la decimos en un campo de juego.
Unfortunately, sometimes we get our revenge on the field, says Patricio Eleisegui. He's an Argentinian fan who visited Mexico City's Aztec Stadium yesterday. Maradona is perfection, Eleisegui says. So to understand Maradona's life is to understand Argentina's history in the last 60 years. Rodolfo Colalongo is a professor of international relations from Argentina who specializes in populist movements.
A ver, estuvo con Néstor, después Cristina, y visitaba periódicamente a Fidel Castro.
Colalongo explains that Maradona cultivated friendships with Argentina's two most progressive presidents in recent memory, Néstor and Cristina Kirchner. He also befriended many of Latin America's leftist leaders, most notably Hugo Chávez of Venezuela and Fidel Castro of Cuba. Maradona once interviewed Castro on a TV show he called The Lefty, a reference to his dominant foot and his politics. In their sit-down conversation, they both lamented how, in their opinion, Latin America could have been everything and is instead nothing. Then Maradona rolled up his left pant leg. Maradona showed Castro a tattoo on his left calf. It was Castro's face. He also had the face of communist revolutionary Che Guevara on his right shoulder. Here's international relations professor Colalongo.
Digamos que tiene algo que nosotros conocemos y se llama como el orgullo de clase. Él nunca dejó de ser.
He had what we could call pride in his social class, Colalongo says. Maradona came from a working class family, and he never forgot that. And in a way, it came at a cost for Maradona.
Claro, por supuesto que se lo criticó muchísimo, muchísimo con eso.
He was often criticized in Argentina for his political views, Colalongo says. Also for his well-documented long-time battle with drug addiction. And yet, Colalongo says Maradona, in the end, was apolitical.
Su figura representa una unión más allá del ámbito político.
He represented something beyond the political sphere, Colalongo says. That's why hundreds of mourners chanted his name and gathered outside his wake in Argentina's presidential house. In the crowd, a fan wearing the red and white jersey for Buenos Aires club team River Plate, and a fan wearing the gold and navy jersey for their arch rival, Boca Juniors, did the unthinkable. They embraced, they cried, and they consoled each other. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
Coming up on the program, we devote the rest of the hour to the deep connection between coffee and faith. Get ready to settle in with your favorite cup of Java and enjoy. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. It's been a non-traditional Thanksgiving week for so many of us. It may have been a Zoom gathering for you, or maybe a quiet day with friends and family you live with, keeping the ritual of turkey, stuffing, maybe sweet potatoes. There are lots of different food traditions that connect us to each other, but also to our history, our ancestry, even our faith. For the rest of this hour, we're going to share stories about one ritual you may be familiar with, making that cup of coffee. That's what producer Noon Saleh did for an episode of the podcast Kerning Cultures, Stories from the Middle East and North Africa and the Spaces in Between. Noon starts us off with a story about one man and the deep ties between coffee and the Sufi faith.
There are quite a few variations of the story behind the whole Sufi coffee connection throughout history. One version talks about how this Sufi cleric was traveling through Ethiopia, and he saw some birds behaving strangely after eating some berries off a plant. So then he tried the berries himself and noticed that their ability to kind of to keep him alert. Another version of this connection is about a Sufi shepherd who noticed that his goats, after eating the berries, had the same effect on them. So whichever it was, sometime between the 13th and 16th century, Sufi clerics in Yemen, after discovering coffee's effect, drank it as a stimulant to keep them awake and alert into the night.
Start off by telling me, what's your name?
My name is Abdullah. This is what I go by currently, and I assume from now on. But I've had a lot of names throughout my life, actually.
He's an interesting, very interesting guy. Has one of the most complicated, complex, and layered backgrounds I have ever, I had ever heard.
So my name on my birth certificate is Eric David Rothman. And then when I was a teenager, my father told me that he wanted to name me Ezekiel. And that he sort of lost that argument with my mom. And then when I became Muslim, I was given the name Abdullah by the sheikh that I made my shahada with.
So for simplicity's sake, we'll go with Abdullah. So Abdullah is a 44-year-old father of three, born and raised in Seattle in the northwest of the United States. At the beginning of the interview, he takes me into his kitchen.
It kind of looks like a chemist's lab.
It does look like
he's preparing a cup of coffee. And he opens up the pantry, like his the cabinet in the kitchen, and there's like bags upon bags upon bags of coffee. To me, they all look exactly the same. But they're beans from 16 different countries, I think. I believe he had 16 different countries. And that wasn't even the most amazing part. He has the most impressive selection of gadgets that I've ever come across as far as coffee is concerned. I mean, it was incredible.
Yeah, so this is a filter, and it's a metal, it's a metal like disc, but then I put a cotton filter around it that's changeable.
Okay.
But you kind of need to keep it wet.
And this brew that he's about to make with me standing in his kitchen is this whole lengthy process involving burners and measuring cups and scales and homemade grinders.
This is the part that's a little precarious because it's all glass and you know metal. And now I'm pulling on this thing that has a spring and sometimes it pops. Yeah, like that.
He's got all the like high-end stuff, but he's also got a bunch of antique roasters from his travels with these ornate etchings as well as some homemade gadgets that he's built himself.
I built them. Yeah, I have three roasters that I built myself. And I have this like console to control them, to control the heat and the air that I built out of like different electrical.
How does one learn how to build a coffee roaster?
The internet.
Coffee to Abdullah is a lot more than a drink. It's a lot more than that buzz to just get you through the day. In fact, to Abdullah, coffee, the drink, the bean, the cultivation, the origin, it's all part of what he believes is recognizing one's path to true spiritual enlightenment.
And so if somebody does anything with an amount of consciousness and awareness and intention, then it can elevate that experience and it can become a spiritual experience and therefore a spiritual vehicle for connecting to God. For me, everything's spiritual, And coffee, not only is there this essence of it in and of itself, but the history to it is spiritual. But in the process itself, like just even that appreciation for the essence of the coffee versus this dead coffee bean, right?
This dead coffee bean Abdullah is describing is the coffee you often find in coffee shops, where the bean is over-roasted to allow for a longer shelf life.
And so for me, that's such a key factor for when we talk about spirituality, we're talking about the unseen essence of something, right? That's literally what the word spirit means. And it's that essence that really makes something alive, and it makes it what it is. So if you were to...
This type of spiritual awareness was ingrained in Abdullah early on in his life. He traveled around the world in order to gain a sense of spiritual understanding. His journeys took him to Jamaica.
I sort of was involved in like Rastafarian culture and the spiritual tradition, not the sort of like Bob Marley and smoking weed type of thing.
A commune on a hill outside of Santa Cruz, California.
In a Hindu community, studying yoga and studying with this this guy, Baba Hari Das, this guru who hadn't spoken for 40 years and taught on a chalkboard.
Palestine and Israel.
And I lived with Jewish community, I lived with Muslims, and I lived with the Black Hebrew Israelite community.
He also lived with Yemeni Jews and was a shepherd for 7 months after then moving to East Asia to live with a Buddhist monk in the jungles of central Thailand. For the past 15 years, Abdullah has woken up at 3 a.m. to pray and do dhikr.
I use beads and I'm in a sort of saying things that get me into a state of remembrance, but then really trying to cultivate a place of a state of presence. What I'm saying, I'm not saying anything out loud, it's in my heart. Okay. But this, there is a sound of the beads because I use this 1,000 beads strand, and so when I'm doing it sort of fast, and so it makes a kish 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 sound. And it's in this middle of the night, which is considered this sacred time when the Sakina is like closer to the earth, meaning like sort of you're able to access this connection to God easier because there's this closer connection in the middle of the night. And it's sort of, you know, the idea is everyone else is asleep and you're there alone with you and your Lord.
And for Abdullah, coffee and its enjoyment, its appreciation, is somehow a manifestation of the divine.
I don't want to drink. I don't want to find the one coffee that I like and stick to it. I literally specifically want, I want a fruity one on this day. I want an Ethiopian one on this day. I want a Guatemalan because I want to revel in the beauty of diversity. All of that diversity and all that engagement is a dhikr. It's a way of remembering the oneness, remembering the truth.
Coming up, Abdullah finds a coffee skeptic in his own home. This is a special hour of The World with our podcast partner, Kerning Cultures, stories from the Middle East and North Africa and the spaces in between. We'll be right back here on The World.
A reminder to listeners, The World is free for anyone, on air, on demand, and on the web. We report stories from around the globe with nuance, context, and by listening to the voices of the people most affected by the news. Donate to The World today to support the work of our superhero staff and help us keep our coverage free and open to all. You can help keep the show accessible to everybody across the globe by donating $100. That's just $8.33 a month. Help us make our goal and you'll receive an invite to a virtual party with the incredible people who make this show possible. To give, visit theworld.org/whoweare or follow the link right here in the episode notes. Stay safe. Stay healthy, and thank you.
On today's special program, the spiritual side of brewing coffee.
I still remember once his dad came to stay with us, and he told him, "All I need in the morning is a cup of coffee." So my husband, he printed out 32 steps of how to make a cup of coffee.
Don't cut corners. That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH in Boston and PRX. This hour, stories about faith, identity, and coffee. Let's return to Abdullah and the connection he's found between coffee and the divine. Abdullah came to embrace Sufism through his wife Esra, but at one point in their marriage, she had some questions about his attachment, dare we say obsession, with that little bean.
So within the first year of being married to my wife, I was getting more and more into the coffee, and so I was doing all this research, and I was into buying my first espresso machine because now we had a home, you know, and you know, you get married and you have a registry and you get like kitchen things, right? And so I was like, oh, I want to get a coffee maker. I've never had that. So I had to get the best, and I did all this research, and so I got into the making of coffee. And so she was seeing that I was spending a lot of time with this, right? And so she started getting worried, because in her orientation to Islam, attachment to anything is like a nafs thing. You get attached, you're supposed to break these attachments, you know?
So his wife Isra calls up her Sufi sheikh, or her religious teacher or mentor, for guidance.
And she's convinced that he's going to sort of say like he shouldn't do that, right? And so he gives her this whole dars, this whole lesson on the coffee bean and bun and the spiritual reality of coffee. And he starts saying like, you know, coffee is the blessed bean, and it's the only seed other than the date seed, which we know is, you know, revered within Islam in the Prophet's time. Both these two seeds are the only ones that have the aleph in the seed. So this
coffee bean, as well as the date seed, have this line down the middle. Sufis believe that that line is spiritually significant, that it represents alif, which is the first letter of the Arabic alphabet.
Which is basically like a one, and it's also connected to like when you say the shahada.
Shahada, the declaration of faith.
You put your one finger in the up to represent tawhid, or the unity, the oneness of God. And so this... he starts telling her that this coffee bean has a secret to it, a spiritual secret. It keeps away the devil, it keeps away shaitan, and that not only is it good to drink, that you should actually keep the coffee bean in your house, and you should keep some in your cupboard because it will keep shaitan away. And he said, not only should you be okay with Abdullah drinking coffee, but you should sit with him and enjoy a cup of coffee every once in a while. And so I'm like, yes, you know.
You won that argument.
Yeah, exactly.
You kept that coffee machine.
Right. Kept it. And it was like, from then on, I was like, hey, this is legit. I get to do this.
And the thing is, it came with the package. It came with him. So I had to, you know, I had to accept it.
This is Isra, Abdullah's wife.
And his gadgets and everything. I mean, it's a lot.
It takes up room in the house.
I still remember once his dad came to stay with us, and he told him, all I need in the morning is a cup of coffee. And so my husband, before leaving to work, he printed out, literally and stapled, three pages with 32 steps of how to make a cup of coffee. And his dad wakes up in the morning, and he sees the paper, and he starts laughing. He's like, I'm going to Wegmans to get like Nescafe to make a cup of coffee.
Oh no.
And he's like, are you serious? You wrote me 32 steps to make a cup of coffee. And he thought it was totally normal. He's like, here's.
And although Abdullah has invested himself entirely and completely and independently to the craft, coffee and the sort of social culture around it has historically been a communal activity.
You know, when you think of coffee, you think of people coming together in these coffee houses. And what happened is that there's this thing of people together connecting while they drink coffee. So it's this ritual of sitting with one another, sipping the coffee, and having conversation heart to heart, and coming up with ideas and reflecting the experience of being human in the other. And this is a very, very central aspect to Islam, and therefore to Sufism, which is the concept of suhba, which is companionship. And it's not just...
I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. The next stop on our coffee journey takes us to the United Arab Emirates. Producer Noon Saleh introduces us to a woman who spent her life thinking about coffee. To meet her, Noon heads to a farm outside of Abu Dhabi.
Ahlan, marhaba. السلام عليكم.
نسلم من بعيد.
الله يسلمك.
كيف حالك؟
اهلا.
انت
نون.
انا
نينا.
When we first spoke over the phone, she told me she was the UAE's foremost expert in coffee, and the room she welcomed us into may have been all the proof that we needed to back up that statement.
This place is amazing.
There were coffee mementos everywhere. There was this enormous wall-to-wall wallpaper of a timeline of coffee's history. Teapots adorned every shelf. Hundreds of books of poetry and history lined the walls at either end of the room.
Well, my name is Ghaya Al-Dahiri.
Ghaya is an anthropologist and a researcher.
I deal with heritage and culture.
So Ghaya actually speaks English fairly well. My translator was thrown off a bit.
This is going to be interesting. Okay, let's make another deal. If you speak in English, I translate in Arabic.
Ghaya is a small-statured woman, 75 years old, maybe 5'4", but her voice and her laugh are hearty and larger than life. As I begin to ask her about coffee, Ghaya can't help but take us throughout her past, all the way to her childhood and to memories of her grandmother. She mentions her grandmother throughout this interview. She was connected to her in such a profound, loving way. And every time Ghaya mentions her grandmother, her entire demeanor softens and she smiles really warmly.
She used to be so soft in her. She was tall, elegant. She was the head of the neighborhood in a way.
And her grandmother instilled in Ghaya a passion she has nurtured and held on to for the past 7 decades, the art of coffee. For Ghaya, coffee, the drink itself, carries a history and tradition so sacred and so personal that it propels her into poetry. Almost a whimsical song, eyes closed behind her glasses, swaying, a look of sheer happiness. Ghaya told us about this memory she had from when she was about 6 or 7 years old, of seeing her grandmother in front of the fire, grinding and roasting coffee beans in a white dress against the black night sky.
The scene is so beautiful. Like, it's beautiful in a way that it's beyond description. She said the fire was in front of the grandma. The grandma was wearing white. She was doing her grinding of the coffee. And there were around the fire copper plates. And these plates were reflecting the fire lights. And it looked like gold for her. It looked like something so pretty compared to a vision of a child to see all that prettiness. And that's where that spark of the passion for coffee started.
That night was truly a memorable moment for her, one she remembers so vividly and has stayed with her, shepherding her through her life. And this age-old process of making coffee in an Emirati home is all about atmosphere, tradition, and lots of time. While grinding, there's usually poetry being recited, either for memorization or original works, like the poem Ghaya performed for us. Ghaya is eager to show us the process that begins by roasting beans over the fire.
Okay, so the coffee beans have a shell kind of thing to protect it from being damaged. And she's going to show us what's going to happen with these just in a moment.
She then pours the coffee beans into a wooden box that she shakes back and forth, which both cools down the beans to stop them from overcooking and also separates the shells from the bean. She then brings the hot water. Needless to say, we were all pretty excited. Even Hibar, our translator, who is not a huge coffee fan, was eager to try.
There was never a time that someone presented me a cup of coffee and I wanted it. I took it out of politeness. And now, like, I'm dying to try this coffee.
Your first real cup of coffee.
She excitedly tells us to gather around and see, an important step not to be missed. She is showing us the moment to look out for, when the bubbles in the liquid reach the right color. Once the coffee reaches a golden color, she removes it from the fire. And you wait.
2 minutes.
This is probably the 3,000th pot of coffee that Ghaya has ever made in her lifetime. But her excitement and thrill at showing us each meticulous step is as if she's witnessing the magic for the first time. She finds this connection to coffee so enthralling, so important. She wrote a book on it called Voice of Rashad, History and Coffee Maker. So Rashad is from the Arabic word rushd, which means to lead or guide. And in the past, travelers used to use the rashad as a warning sound to alert the town of any imminent danger. But the other purpose of the rashad...
The best excellent coffee maker used to be the one who wakes up earlier than the other coffee expert to make sure that she's the one who's making that noise.
Ghaya likens the sounds to church bells.
So when people wake up for the Fajr prayer and the wake up call, and that's the phrase that she used, it's a wake up call. So they would say, we woke up on the voice of the Rashad, of that family.
A source of pride amongst the community was to say, I woke up to the sound of so and so's Rashad.
فهو في العادة يعني دائما المرأة اللي هي تعمل القهوة لازم هي تطعم قبل.
So the woman who prepared the coffee has to take the first drink to make sure that it's the right with everything, with the ingredients, with everything provided.
She pours the golden colored coffee from her grandmother's coffee pot.
How did it taste?
It tastes nice.
She didn't close her eyes. So I think
I closed my eyes. I did. I smell it and I closed my eyes.
When you take a sip of coffee, you're not supposed to drink it immediately and swallow it. You're supposed to have that conversation between the taste and the smell and the flavors around you before you actually swallow it.
Yeah, she's calling the fusion of it in the mouth a conversation.
A conversation.
Right?
Yeah. This is an art. Even drinking it now is an art. This is hard. Raising the standards.
It's a pleasure.
At this point, Raya urges us to sit down as guests, not as interviewers.
We have to actually go and sit down.
We have to start acting up like guests and sitting in.
Okay, let's make our way over there.
Well, it's late.
Does she want us to sit anywhere in particular?
لا أنا أريد أدق شوية يعني أدق فنيان.
She wants to grind a bit.
She wants to grind some coffee using the Rashad. She sits, heels tucked in on the ground, just like this, twice a day, head bowed. She begins. Every home has a different sound. Her home, her digga, is just like her grandmother's. Raya does this, eyes closed, smiling. We pause the recording at Rai's insistence that we enjoy the coffee, that we are in the moment, that we are her guests. Coffee in Emirati households isn't a drink to quench the thirst. That's why you don't fill the cup. Instead, it's meant to be drunken enjoyment accompanied by poetry, in conversation, in negotiations, in prospective marriage and arrangements. And for Raya, its history and its entry into her society intertwines with her idea of family, heritage, identity, and nationalism and the past that she so clearly remembers. As we sit in Raya's living room, surrounded by coffee pots, spices, and family portraits, we take a moment to smell the coffee.
What does it smell to you?
I think it smells like home.
Ya salam. أجمل وصف سمعته. Smell like home. And no place like home.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. This hour, global stories about coffee. Producer Noon Saleh continues.
For our last chapter, our story takes us to Oakland, California, by way of Yemen, where one man sought to bring together his past, his present, and parts of his identity, all with the help of a coffee bean.
My full name is Mukhtar Faisal Hamoud Nashid Yahya Muhammad Hadi Saleh Al-Khanchali. That's my name.
Mukhtar is a Yemeni-American entrepreneur in specialty coffee. He lives in Oakland, California. We spoke via Zoom for this interview. He's sitting in his office, which is essentially a warehouse, high ceilings, large windows, a lot of light. Mukhtar is a conduit, so to speak, between coffee farmers in Yemen and the rest of the world. He lives, breathes, and absolutely adores all things coffee.
Kenyan coffees typically have a very green apple, very citrus, bright flavor to it. Coffees from Guatemala tend to be more chocolate. Brazil, a lot of nuts, peanuts, you know, walnuts. Panama has this very special variety called Gesha. Yemen coffees are very unique because...
He knows his stuff, and so he gives us a quick tour of his office warehouse, phone in hand.
So yeah, when you make coffees, it's not so like technical. You just got to make sure you have the right water-coffee ratio.
And you see racks and racks of coffee beans, equipment, and things I can't even recognize. And it was specifically through discovering coffee that Mukhtar explored and connected with parts of his identity, pages of his past, and the deep connection to the idea of home. Mukhtar, like many people who identify with this classification of third culture, has always straddled between two identities.
I have my family's Yemeni heritage, our history, our traditions, our culture and food, music. But I also love hip hop, and I love, you know, pop culture and movies and all these things, and, you know, growing up here. And so Sometimes it was hard growing up to figure out where do I belong, and you know, am I Yemeni, am I American? And sometimes I didn't feel like I belonged in either.
As a Sudanese-American myself, I understand the sentiment so well. And for Mukhtar, this feeling of not quite fitting in here or there carried through some of the more complicated and sensitive times in U.S. history.
After September 11th, it was very difficult because now suddenly you're like this boogeyman and people are looking at you as a quote-unquote enemy. And the images that are portrayed about your people and culture are not positive. There is no reference of Yemen anywhere. The only reference of Yemen besides, you know, desert and Al-Qaeda and all these things was one reference in this Friends episode.
Hi. I need a fake ticket to Yemen.
One ticket to Yemen?
Oh, no.
When Chandler Bing has to, like, escape Janice and he says he's going to go to Yemen, some random country. No one really remembers it, but every Yemeni knows that episode.
Well, then I guess I'm going to Yemen. I'm going to Yemen.
Mukhtar's parents, for fear that he would mix with the wrong crowd and go down the wrong path, decided to send him to Yemen for a year to live with his grandfather.
I hated it. I was like, you know, what am I doing? I was just like, this, do I pack water with me? Like, I didn't even know what Yemen was like. I'm a 14-year-old kid in high school. It was very, very strange. It's interesting, that year felt like 10 years. It felt like I went into the wardrobe from Narnia.
But when he returned back to the U.S., reality sunk in.
Freshman year of high school. 50 Cent's In the Club just came out.
And so that duality of his character, coupled with just this overall strangeness of preteens and navigating one's identity, Mukhtar was yet again back to balancing and trying to make sense of who he was and where he fit. And it wasn't until college that Mukhtar's dual identities would finally converge.
This is a special edition of The World with our podcast partner, Kerning Cultures, stories from the Middle East and North Africa and the spaces in between. We've been looking at how people find connection and meaning through coffee. Producer Noon Salah picks up our story of coffee entrepreneur Mukhtar Alkanshali.
I did not drink coffee 7 years ago. I would drink that in college to stay up for exams, you know, to jam, you know, to study longer or drive late nights. But I didn't really like it. And my first kind of like aha moment was I found out about Yemen's coffee history.
Despite the alarming fact that most Yemenis don't drink coffee,
like only 15% of coffee is consumed in Yemen.
Yemen has a long-standing relationship with coffee. The high elevations of its landscapes and its unique microclimate makes it fertile ground for growing some of the world's most sought-after coffee beans.
So the Arab tribes there live on these high mountaintops for defensive purposes, and they forced the mountain to grow their produce by making these very beautiful, lush terraces that grow things that they need to survive, and some from those are coffee. And because of that, the coffees in Yemen are under a lot of stress. They don't have a lot of water, and they produce very vibrant flavors.
After the Ottoman Turks occupied Yemen, coffee's popularity spread with the empire. The beans generally were exported from the southwestern part of Yemen, the port city of Mocha. Yes, like the drink. In fact, the coffee from that region took on the name of the port. And with that, the world was introduced to and fell in love with coffee.
For 200 years, almost, Yemen had a complete monopoly on coffee. And I was just enthralled with this history of coffee and how, like, when coffee came from Yemen to Europe, in London, Vienna, you know, Paris, people before coffee would drink alcohol, and that's kind of all they did.
Discovering Yemen's role in coffee was almost the perfect push Mukhtar needed in order to once again decide to visit his homeland and explore what this could mean for him professionally.
Okay, we're here today in Bura. It's one of the most famous coffee-growing regions in Yemen.
So I would go to these villages. And I went to 32 different regions across Yemen. I would go to these places I would read about, and I would go and I would look for coffee. Yeah.
He told me this was going to be one of the hardest hikes of my life, and he was not kidding.
A lot of these places, bumpy roads, and some of them you can't even drive. You had to get off the car and then hike the rest of the journey to this mountain village.
And unfortunately, cars can't come over here, so the only way to go up is to hike with all of our luggage bags. So, and use a few donkeys, a donkey over here. Otherwise, you can't go up. in search for the best coffee, sometimes you have to sacrifice something. Vali told me, so here we are. Hopefully see you guys on the top.
For me, that was probably the most incredible part of my life. It was so the unknown.
And so everywhere Mukhtar went, he felt this generosity, this eagerness to welcome him, to embrace him. He was telling me that in the villages he would visit, they would have these books.
Like these giant books that you sign in and you write like memories or notes. They would go into lines, people, and I remember seeing this line formation. I asked my friends, like, what are they doing? He said, oh, they're doing a lottery system to see who gets to host you, because everybody wants you to be your host.
And Mukhtar, as this newcomer, but not really, found himself ideally situated to leverage his two identities, which in the past were contradictory or in opposition to one another. He actually made them work as he delved deeper and learned more about the people and the coffee.
And that's when everything kind of clicked, and I kind of felt this is where my past, you know, culture and my identity and my future, everything kind of fit together.
And so Mukhtar flourished. He completely immersed himself amongst the Yemeni coffee growers, observed the cultivation, learned the scents, the taste, the techniques, the roasts, everything.
I felt even more a sense of like responsibility. You know, I hope I can do something to help them, or what, I don't know what I can do. So I tried to never promise things. I was under promise. And in that first trip, I just told them I'm doing a report.
He formed relationships with farmers. He learned how to measure rainfalls, hiked, slept on mountains, observed their practices, listened to their songs, poems, and tales of their ancestors. He was determined to soak it all in and knew that if he could just get farmers to elevate the quality of their beans, they'd make more money and, most importantly, embrace coffee growing again. And it worked.
And now it is a story of adventure, war, and the search for the perfect cup of coffee.
You may not be thinking about what it took to get those beans from crop to cup. But the man you're about to hear from sure did. His story is now being told in a new book by celebrated author Dave Eggers.
Here's the moment of truth.
Mukhtar's story and his coffee were a hit back in the U.S., and his beans could soon be found in numerous roasters across the country. His coffee is priced between $4.25 and $20.
And so what I'm trying to do is, let's go back to the way coffee was produced. People were paid fair. Coffee was known where it came from. It was really, there was a lot of transparency. And coffee was not a dollar a cup. For some reason, coffee, we've been programmed to think it's a cheap thing. It can't be like everything else we can pay for, like really expensive headphones. You know, we can pay for so many different things, you know, but coffee, I'm trying to educate people and let them know that this is a different type of coffee. This is a coffee that...
And there's a lot that goes into the coffee that Mukhtar exports. If we try to decipher how many hands were involved in the process of seed to table...
I think it's 20 pairs of hands. That number.
20 pairs of hands. So much work.
Yeah, it's kind of mind-boggling to think about it. Like, I don't know that many things in the world that has that many people who involved along the route before it gets to a consumer.
And this is what Mukhtar really stresses, where he feels super strong about.
If you just purchase coffee that was ethically sourced every day, first of all, it'll taste much better. But that cup that you pay, you know, a little bit more per cup, it will have a huge ripple effect, and it would impact somebody in Kenya and Yemen and in Guatemala. You know, it's about traceability and about all paying people fair wages and understanding your beverage in a more intimate way.
And for Mukhtar, that is a part of what he's striving to do with his beans.
And I think we're going back to coffee as a social conduit, as a drink to build community. And so that's kind of my goal. And I have this thing I always say, the shortest distance between two people is a cup of coffee. You can see a picture of somebody. They can be in Africa. They could be in China. They can be in SF. And you know exactly what they're doing. They're having a really dope conversation. It's a universal experience. It's a place where we build community.
You've been listening to a special hour of coverage. Our thanks to producer Noon Salah and the podcast Kerning Cultures, stories from the Middle East and North Africa and the spaces in between. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. And one more thing, we want to give a fond farewell to Andrea Crossan, our executive producer. After 16 years in Boston and 7 years before that in London, Andrea's returning home to British Columbia, where a new chapter awaits. We will miss her and wish her well. Margot Werman's back in the host chair Monday.